Next case, 10-819, State of Ohio versus Moore Maboji. Mr. Hastings.
May it please the Chief Justice, other members of the court, Mr. Heenan. My name is Robert Hastings. I represent the appellant in this matter, Moore Maboji. This case presents the issue of the filing of an affidavit pursuant to 2935.09 of the revised code, which was amended on June 30th of 2006. In this case, the complainant filed an affidavit and a complaint in municipal court in Hamilton County. The prosecution proceeded, and Mr. Maboji was convicted. In his appeal to the First District Court of Appeals, his eighth assignment of error dealt with the issue of whether or not the trial court, had jurisdiction to hear the matter and proceed with the matter in light of the statute. The Court of Appeals held that they did. We're before the court today to ask the court to examine the statute, which requires the affidavit first to be submitted to a reviewing official. If the reviewing official is not available, it's to be then given to the clerk. And the clerk then is mandatorily supposed to forward it to a reviewing official. I think it's clear in this case that there was never any reviewing official.
What happened once it was filed with the clerk?
Then it went the normal course through the assignment of the case to a judge on a plea of not guilty at arraignment.
Well, that's what happened, but it's filed with the clerk.
Correct.
And the clerk should have gone to the law department, either, I don't know whether municipal or county would have reviewed it at the time, but that didn't happen.
Correct.
So an arrest warrant was issued based on that filing of that complaint.
That's correct.
And once the defendant, your client, was apprehended, I'm presuming he was arrested?
Correct.
Okay. By the police, and then the process of the preliminary arraignment before the municipal court, et cetera?
Yes.
Okay. So you're saying between the police officers creating the warrant for his arrest and the filing with the clerk's office, there should have been a reviewing official pursuant to statute, and that official would have signed off on this case, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. The reviewing officials are defined by statute as being a judge of the court, a magistrate of the court, or the prosecutor, and none of those individuals were involved in this situation. The private citizen has a right under the statute to file the affidavit, but he does not have a right, or she does not have a right, to file the complaint. And the issue is whether or not this complaint that eventually was filed in this case was ever properly deposited with the clerk. And we submit that it was not. And that's the language that this court used in the Rouse case, that in order to file something, it had to be properly deposited for filing with the clerk.
And the flaw was not having that complaint reviewed.
Correct.
But it could have been filed with the clerk and then reviewed.
No, it couldn't be filed with the clerk. It could be presented to the clerk. Then the clerk is mandatorily required by the statute. It says shall present it to a reviewing official, and that was not done.
Mr. Hastings, my reading of 2935.09D says that a private citizen having knowledge of facts seeking to cause an arrest or prosecution may file an affidavit charging an individual. Was there an affidavit in this case or
yes,
not?
Yes, there was, Your Honor.
There was. The document I show says a complaint, and it was signed by Katrina McCall. Was
she
it a complaint
signed,
or was
she
it an
signed
affidavit
both,
or
Honor.
Were both?
Excuse me, Your Honor. She signed both. They're attached to the appellant's brief. They were filed simultaneously and signed simultaneously by Ms. McCall.
So on the basis of the affidavit and the complaint, the prosecution went forward without the intervention of any reviewing official as required by the statute.
That's correct.
So this is a case of statutory interpretation, and you want us to determine whether or not that step of review precludes the conviction.
That's correct. If
your client was sentenced to an 8-month period of community control,
that is
correct. That's
correct, Your Honor.
Has that been completed?
No, it is. It was stayed pending the appeal, Your Honor.
All right. And what did the appellate court do in this instance?
In this instance, the Court of Appeals found that the trial court did have jurisdiction. They basically applied this court's reasoning of reading 29-3509 and 29-3910 in paramateria based on the case that was decided 6 months before the enactment of the amendment. And so I don't know whether they realized that they did that, but that's what they did. Their reasoning was based on a decision of this court that was decided 6 months before the statute that we have before the court was enacted, and obviously their analysis was with regard to the old statute.
Does your research show any cases interpreting this statute since the amendment?
Well, the closest that comes is In re Slayman. Slayman was a situation where a defendant wanted to file a complaint against a detective. And first the complaint was, or the affidavit was given to the clerk. The clerk gave it to the prosecutor. Then, getting no response, then the defendant presented the affidavit to the judge. The judge then referred the matter to the prosecutor. The prosecutor reviewed the matter and declined to prosecute. The other situation was a mandamus case out of the Fifth District Court of Appeals, and that's State X Rel Muff versus Wohlenberg. And in that case, the complainant was trying to file a private complaint, again, with regard to a criminal offense. And the court found that in a mandamus that he had no clear legal right to file the complaint. He had a clear legal right to file the affidavit, but not the complaint. And so they made a very clear distinction that under this law that you can do one, but you have to follow the rest of the procedures. Obviously, the legislative intent of the General Assembly in this law is clear. They mention reviewing official 7 times in the statute itself.
But in this case, it was filed then. And was there an objection raised in the trial court to the defective complaint?
Well, that's the very issue, Your Honor, whether it was properly filed. Being filed and being properly filed are two different matters.
Was there an objection raised in the trial court to the defective, what you claim to be a defective complaint?
No, Your Honor.
That wouldn't that argument be waived then, the defect be waived?
Your Honor, these cases that we've cited to the court and even the court's case in Rouse recognize the concept of subject matter jurisdiction.
Subject matter jurisdiction would be the ability of the trial court to decide domestic violence cases, would it not?
No. It would be the court's power to hear any properly filed complaint. The complaint is the jurisdictional document in municipal court.
But isn't this a personal jurisdiction? The court clearly has authority to decide cases involving domestic violence, which is traditionally the subject matter jurisdiction conferred by statute. In this case, the jurisdiction was improperly invoked, but the personal jurisdiction over the defendant. And so isn't that a waivable matter?
Personal jurisdiction is, but subject matter jurisdiction is not waivable.
Mr. Hastings, how does this interface with Criminal Rule 3, which, as Justice Kupp is talking about, the validity of the complaint, Criminal Rule 3 talks about, what the requirements of the written statement, and apparently in this situation, all of Criminal Rule 3 has been satisfied, correct?
If you read the language of the complaint that was filed in this case, the criteria are present. But if the court believed that all that had to happen is a private citizen could fill out a complaint that met the statutory criteria or the criteria set forth in the rule, it would completely wipe out Section 293509. It would be as though the General Assembly never enacted the law.
Counsel, you talked about legislative intent. One of the legislative intents in passing this was to prevent the frivolous filings, which subjected somebody to have to respond or have to deal with it, and then it was dismissed because it was frivolous. In this case, it obviously got to the point that there was a reviewing officer, a prosecutor, eventually did look at it, determined it was a valid complaint, and pursued it to the point that you ended up with a plea. So the purpose that the legislation was passed was cured by the fact that eventually a court of law and a prosecutor reviewed it and your client pled.
Your Honor, the review has to happen before the complaint is filed, not after. There was a trial in this matter.
So, counsel, your suggestion is that we elevate form over substance. The reason for the review is to ensure, as Justice Stratton said, that there is sufficiency in the complaint. You had a judge who reviewed the complaint, a prosecutor, they proceeded to trial, there was a conviction, and you would have us set aside that conviction.
There's nothing in the record that reflects that a judge reviewed the complaint or that the prosecutor reviewed the complaint. The only thing in the record is that the complaint was filed.
Well, counsel, for a prosecutor to proceed on a criminal matter, you can't do that as a prosecutor without reading the complaint.
Well, they could read the complaint and see the complaint was in compliance with Rule 3, but they didn't.
They had the affidavit and they had the complaint.
That's correct.
And that formed the basis for their prosecution. Now, admittedly, if there was no affidavit with it, you would be on much stronger footing, I believe. But to say that at no time was it reviewed by an official, it may not have been reviewed prior to the clerk starting the process, which resulted in the warrant and then the arrest. But once the case came to the prosecutor's attention, both the affidavit and the complaint were reviewed. That's just what happens in the system. And so, to get to Justice McGee Brown's statement, form over substance, that there was sufficiency in this matter.
Your Honor, I believe that in this situation that before they can get to the prosecution, they have to have the proper institution of the prosecution, and they did not. I think that's...
Was the prosecuting attorney precluded from dismissing the case once it landed on his or her desk?
They're privileged to do that at any time.
Okay. So presumably, reflecting on my experience, that if there is a case that turns out to be insufficient at the get-go, a prosecutor will take a long, hard look at it, and if there's no reason to proceed, they're not going to proceed just to proceed.
Well, again, you're saying it's form over substance. I'm saying it's the law of Ohio, and it isn't being followed.
Mr. Hastings, could you tell us what you would suggest is the way that this should work, just in this particular case, once the affidavit is signed by the individual? Because I'm curious as to what you believe reviewing means.
I believe it's like the case in Slavin, where the prosecutor has to look at it or the judge has to look at it.
And there has to be a stamp of some type or a signature?
Yes. And then the clerk gets that it's okay to be filed, and then it can be filed, but not until that time.
Counsel, would it be fair to suggest the reason for this is that you can't unring the bell for any citizen against whom a criminal complaint is filed? Once it's there, it's there. It's part of your record for the rest of your life.
Well, that's very true. And that's why it has to be done correctly from the start. It can't be remedied along the way just because someone ignores the statute.
The way the statute works, the reviewing authority, reviewing official is one of three officials, the judge, the magistrate, or the prosecutor.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Heenan.
Justice O'Donnell, you'd asked if there have been any other cases that have looked at this since, and there have been two First District cases. I don't believe that they were published. They are State versus Kendrick, which can be found 2001 Ohio 212, and State versus Blair, which is at 2010 6310. Both those cases, the court didn't look at Boylan. What it looked at is it looked at what is the subject matter jurisdiction of the municipal court.
Are those post-amendment statutes,
yes.
Mr. Heenan?
Yes.
Post-amendment cases?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The one came out, I believe, just 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
The way the First District looked at those cases is it looked at what is the subject matter jurisdiction of the municipal court, and it's any misdemeanor committed within that court's territorial jurisdiction. It then looked at what, you know, was this a crime that fell into that category, and it did. It then looked at the complaint and looked at Criminal Rule 3 and said under Criminal Rule 3, the three elements that need to be here are here.
Yes.
On its face, this is a valid complaint. That conferred subject matter jurisdiction to the trial court.
So they've said you can ignore the statute then, essentially.
I don't believe it's an issue of ignoring the statute. I believe it's...
Well, what else would it be if it's...
It would be a situation where if there's a defect in the complaint or the affidavit, that Criminal Rule 12C is there to be used for that purpose. That's why Criminal Rule 12C is there, that if there's a problem with the complaint and the defendant feels there is something that's serious enough that should be raised, then that rule is there for them to bring this up. And then it can be reviewed. At that point, it's a matter of personal jurisdiction, not subject matter jurisdiction.
For whatever reason, this statute seems to carve out, after it defines what a reviewing official means, it then carves out obligations of a peace officer who seeks to file a complaint, and then has a special application in subsection D for private citizens with this requirement of a reviewing official. And I thought we were supposed to give some deference to the General Assembly who wrote it, and they surely had some reason for having complaints filed by private citizens reviewed by a reviewing official before the prosecution commences. And it seems like that has been skirted by the cases that you're suggesting, where we sort of just determine if we have jurisdiction over this, and we don't care about the procedural requirements set forth in order to bring the case to the court.
And again, I think that goes to the court's subject matter jurisdiction versus personal jurisdiction, whether or not they had jurisdiction over this person versus jurisdiction over this matter. The subject matter, the court clearly did, and the personal jurisdiction wasn't raised. It was first raised on appeal, and then subject matter jurisdiction was first specifically mentioned here. And I recognize that subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any point in time, obviously, but this is not a subject matter jurisdiction case. This is a personal jurisdiction case.
If this defendant, if this complainant had filed this in juvenile court, you know, went to the clerk and handed this document, the affidavit and the complaint that was created by Ms. McCall, what would that couldn't have happened, correct?
There would be
no subject matter jurisdiction for the juvenile court.
Correct.
So are you saying that this procedure that's set out in the statute is merely to avoid those type of filings, to make sure that a citizen is not using the wrong court? Because as long as you're saying that the subject matter jurisdiction was appropriate to the municipal court, a domestic violence charge, then as long as they're in the right arena, that they should proceed. And you would admit that if the same document under the same circumstances was filed in common pleas court or juvenile court or domestic or probate, it wouldn't fly, correct?
It certainly wouldn't fly in juvenile court, probate, domestic, because those courts do not have subject matter jurisdiction over the crime that was committed in this case. While juvenile would obviously have it if a minor had committed that crime, this right. is not a minor. In fact, there was a case that this court decided, State versus Wilson, that's kind of the opposite situation, which dealt with juvenile bindovers. In that case, it was a number of years later that the defendant said, hey, wait a second, you did this in common pleas. I was a juvenile when this happened, and I was never bound over. In that situation, there was never a judicial determination that this is a case that was appropriate to have the subject matter jurisdiction transferred from the juvenile court to the common pleas court. If that were the situation here, I'd concede that there is no subject matter jurisdiction and that everything against this man should have been thrown out. That's not the situation here. This is a personal jurisdiction issue. It's an issue that could have been addressed and cured by Criminal Rule 12, and it wasn't.
In Criminal Rule 12C that you've brought our attention to, it involves pretrial motions, and it says the following must be raised before trial: defenses and objections based on defects in the institution of the prosecution, defenses and objections based on defects in the indictment information or complaint. And was there an objection raised in the trial, before trial in this case?
No, there was not. It was brought up for the first time on appeal.
Counsel, just looking at the documents here, the complaint obviously had assistance in doing this. Now, it's witnessed by a peace officer, so is that the policeman who was called out, or who is that person?
I will be completely honest with you. I do not know who it was. I just know that the person was authorized to administer oaths.
Well, the complaint is actually typed out, so the affidavit is in her handwriting, or is it? It's printed, so we don't even know if she.
I don't know for certain that she's the person who wrote it out. I don't know that. And honestly, if this had been brought up at trial, those are questions that may have been able to have been brought up.
So what I'm getting at is if a police officer or someone down at the courthouse at the clerk's office did that, they should be well aware of the requirement for review. I would not expect this victim to understand that at all. That would not be a reasonable expectation. But the peace officer or the person at the desk at the clerk's office surely knows the requirements.
They should. And again, but looking at the city of Zanesville versus Rouse, that was a situation where a clerk did something that they weren't supposed to do. They did not follow the procedure they were supposed to follow. But that did not take subject matter jurisdiction away from the trial court.
Counsel, hasn't this court ruled that where a conflict arises between a rule and a statute, as to procedure, that the rule controls?
It does. That was,
State versus Slatter?
I believe so. I know I cited it in my brief. I apologize for not knowing the name off the top
That's
of my head.
That's where I got it.
Okay. Thank you. Hopefully that person was right.
I'm not sure I understand where the conflict would be between the statute and the rule in this case. In fact, the whole procedure for initiating a criminal complaint seems to be a little vague in the rules. Isn't this statute just simply filling in between the rules and the remedy, if you don't follow the statute, is, in fact, as you suggest, file the 12C motion.
And I agree that a 12C motion would have been appropriate to file in this case. But to later bring up a subject matter jurisdiction, this court, the trial court had subject matter jurisdiction over this case. And there was no reason to throw this out then or now or ever on a subject matter jurisdiction ground.
If it had been raised at the trial level, then presumably the court could have dismissed the complaint. The prosecutor or the judge could then have reviewed it and had it refiled, and you'd be right back, but the problem would be cured, correct?
I seriously doubt that we would be here on this case if that had happened. That would be one thing. Whether or not this thing could be just cured by an amendment, I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, as you pointed out.
At the very least, they could dismiss and refile it.
We could have dismissed, refiled it if that was the necessary remedy, but either way, ultimately, this was reviewed by a prosecutor. We're not going to take a worthless case and try it just to try it because we have nothing better to do. We have a lot better things to do. And Justice Pfeiffer, you had mentioned the idea, well, you know, this is going to cause some type of criminal record for him if this happens and that you can't unring that bell. But you know, the legislature has given us an expungement statute that lets that bell be unrung.
Although the statute itself does talk about the review before there's an actual arrest, correct?
Yes, but again, that does not go to subject matter jurisdiction.
Right, I understand that. But when you said, well, it kind of doesn't matter because eventually it was looked at by a prosecutor, if we're really looking at what the statute says specifically, to do it 100% correctly, it should have been reviewed by an official before there had been an arrest.
And again, that may be the case, but again, that's not the issue here today. The issue here today is whether or not following that statute confers subject matter jurisdiction, and it's a statute that has nothing to do with subject matter jurisdiction. It's all personal jurisdiction. Unless the court has any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hastings, you've used up all of your time. You can take 30 seconds.
I think that the prosecutor wants to skip over the part of the analysis and the interpretation of the courts where it says that the complaint has to be properly filed. If it's not properly filed, then the court does not have jurisdiction.
And well, isn't that your criminal rule 12C remedy?
Well, that's with regard to once they that's personal jurisdiction. I'm talking about subject matter jurisdiction. The prosecution would just like to skip the portion of the analysis that says that it has to be properly deposited, to use the court's language, with the clerk. It was never properly deposited with the clerk because there was no review.
And for that proposition, you're relying on what specifically? What case or what statute?
Well, it's the analysis that was in State versus Sharp, which this court then used portions of that analysis in Rouse to talk about subject matter jurisdiction and properly filed complaints. Thank you.
Thank you. Court will take this matter under advisement, and you will be informed of our decision.